Might makes right. That has been the barbaric rule throughout human history that allowed authoritarian regimes to control people, as in the case of slavery. Still, today, Leif Weinar argues the same rule applies to control oil.
That bad old rule is the same rule that's left over now for natural resources. Right now, our rule for the resources of other countries is whoever can seize it by force can sell it to us. So when Saddam took over Iraq in a violent coup many years ago, the world started buying Iraq's oil from him. And then when ISIS took over the same wells recently, the world started buying Iraq's oil from them.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, Leif Weinar, author of Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World, makes the case to stop buying oil from repressive Petrograts and extremists. But first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. With gas prices as low as they've been in decades, concerns about America's dependence on imported oil doesn't seem to resonate with many people these days. Most of the oil we consume is used, of course, for fuel, such as gasoline or for jet fuel. A fair amount of it is used for making various plastics and synthetics. Historically, about half of imported U.S. oil comes from the Northern Hemisphere, while one-fifth comes from Persian Gulf states. But our reliance on oil is troubling because of its serious environmental impacts, air pollution and climate change among those. There is also the risk our dependence on imported oil can pose to security. But there's another argument to be made for why America should break its addiction to foreign oil, a moral argument. Leif Weinar has been making this moral argument for some time now. Weinar is the chair of philosophy and law at King's College in London, and he recently wrote a book, Blood Oil: Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Leif Weinar visited the University of Utah not long ago, and he made the case for why America, and indeed the whole world, should stop buying oil from authoritarian regimes abroad. He says, on the face of it, this seems like an impossible political change. But by the end of his talk, he might convince you that it's not so impossible. Leif Weinar has also been a visiting professor at the Princeton Department of Politics and a visiting professor at Stanford University's Center on Ethics and Society. He's also been a visiting fellow at the Australian National University School of Philosophy, also a fellow for the Center of Ethics and Public Affairs at the Murphy Institute for Political Economy, and also a fellow of the Carnegie Council on Ethics and International Affairs. Leif Weinar's talk was recorded at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on January 26th this year.
I'm going to talk a little bit now about oil and the tyranny of oil and what we can do to get out of business with dictators, armed groups, and extremists abroad. But what I really want to talk to you about here is impossible political change. And I'm just going to ask you, what change would you really like to see locally, nationally, globally? Really top priority for you in your lifetime that you think is long odds or maybe impossible? And I'm asking that because my project does want us to stop buying oil from authoritarian regimes and armed groups in other countries. I believe, like you may believe, that a country belongs to its people, and that includes its natural resources. So unless the people of a country can possibly be agreeing for their natural wealth to be sold off, anyone who sells off the oil or minerals is literally stealing the stuff from the people, and we shouldn't buy it. Our sending our money for natural resources to these foreign countries causes all sorts of problems for them and for us, including some of the worst foreign policy crises and threats that we've seen for the last 40 years. So, a lot of that in detail is what I'm going to say tonight, but you can tell by just about what I've said so far that this is a big ask. We really should, for our own safety and for our own principles, say that we will no longer buy oil from, for example, the Saudi regime, our old allies, or from most of the Gulf states, from Russia, from the big exporters in Central Asia and Africa. 50% of the world's oil is, by our own deepest principles, stolen, and we shouldn't buy it. Now, I've been working for 10 years on explaining that proposition and developing a set of policies that we can enact here to change our own law on our own soil to get us out of business with authoritarians, armed groups, and extremists abroad, so we no longer send our dollars to empower them. And as you can imagine, the reaction is often, great, that's so interesting. But what you are asking for is perhaps highly unlikely. So let me just ask you to start out. In your own view, in your own goals, your own desires, what's a change you'd like to see here in Salt Lake, nationally, globally, that might be seriously challenging? Anyone have an issue that's top shelf for them?
Amr Muhammad. Okay, I'm from Egypt. I'm a PhD student here. I've been here for almost 2 years. As not my first time at the States, I was here as a PhD student, but in North Carolina from 2009, 2011, until the revolution happened in Egypt. I went back to Egypt, and then what happened happened, and then I came back again here in Utah. So for me, the first time I came to the States, 2009, in North Carolina, I lived the freedom for the first time in my life. I didn't imagine that freedom is so delicious, so sweet, like this, with my wife, so we came together here. And when it happened 2011 in Egypt, we said, okay, we will test freedom at our home country. So I went back to Egypt. So I wish for the Middle East people to live the degree of freedom that people here in America and in Europe live it. You cannot imagine how creative they are if they have enough freedom. What you were talking, actually, I have felt it. Because the Saudi regime, they supported Ben Ali. They took it after Tunisia revolution. They even supported Mubarak, but he refused to go there. They stopped all the money, all the oil on Egypt, and they stopped any kind of support. They even supported the army to cause oppression to Egypt and do a military coup. And whenever the army started to stop any kind of demonstration in Egypt and start to put the youth into prison in Egypt, they supported him with more money. Saudis, Emirates, and Kuwait, they supported the military regime in Egypt with more than $26 billion at the last 1.5 years.
Good. So, thank you so much, Amr. That's inspiring. So you hope for peace and freedom for the peoples of the Middle East. Don't we all? Can you imagine a peaceful, free Middle East where the people are in control of their own resources and we don't have this funding of authoritarians and extremists? That's a great example. Thank you so much, Amr. That might seem like an impossible change from where we are. Real progress on climate might seem like an impossible change from where we are. But how many impossible political changes have we seen in our lifetimes? So if I can talk to my older peers for a moment. When I was born, a fairly long time ago, almost half the world's population lived under a communist government. I remember reading my first copy of the Communist Manifesto. Almost half the world was communist. That percentage is down to maybe around 15%, and most of those are Chinese. I hope my Chinese friends will not object if I say that even that government is communist in name only. The battle against communism was impossible until it was won. When I was a teenager, there was a psychologist who was in the news saying, "Isn't it funny that we only dream in black and white?" And I knew that was false. Because growing up in Central Ohio, I had nuclear nightmares, and I knew that my nightmares were in vivid technicolor, because I imagined the purples and the greens of my city being blown up by Soviet missiles. One of our leading political theorists, who's a friend of mine, I hope he won't be embarrassed by saying so, wrote in the 1980s a book that said, imagine that the Soviet Union lasts for another century or two. What should we do? Even in the 80s, the fall of the Soviet Union seemed impossible. 5 years later, it happened almost without a shot being fired. When I was in grad school, I went out with a very active, idealistic young woman who gave me a book called The Apartheid Handbook, which explained in detail how the apartheid system worked. And she said she didn't expect apartheid to be over in her lifetime. Mandela was still in prison. And then look, just a few years later, apartheid ended. When my father grew up in Atlanta, New Orleans, he had black servants. Everybody did. Blacks were occasionally lynched, as were Jews. My father was a Jew. He reports seeing Jews lynched in Atlanta. Even when I was in grad school, there was a band called Public Enemy. Does anyone remember Public Enemy, the big rap band of the time? They were celebrating the fact that there was a black quarterback in the Super Bowl. One of their rap lyrics was, "Ain't never gonna be a black president." And that was 1991. And now look, there is an African-American president. Change seems impossible until the day it comes. And let me share the story from where I live now in London, which I find the most inspiring of all. The most impossible long odds political change in history. So in 1787, 12 Quakers got together in a room in London and swore an absolutely preposterous oath to each other that they were going to help end the Atlantic slave trade. Now, this was crazy. 1787, Britain was the superpower. Its navy ruled the waves. And the slave trade, especially slave-grown sugar, was a huge part of the growing British economy. 5% of GDP and growing. The British establishment was heavily entrenched in the slave trade. You can still see slave money when you see the skyline of London, Bristol, Liverpool. The mayor of London was one of the largest plantation owners in the United Kingdom. Slave trade gave Britain its first millionaire. A certain Lord Hawkesbury had a slave ship named after him. Big banks like Barclays and Lloyds were making lots of money on the slave trade. Even the Church of England had such extensive holdings in the Caribbean that the brand that they burned onto the slaves was universally recognized on all the slave islands. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Anglican Church, was writing letters saying, there seems to be decreases in our Negro population, perhaps resulting from a lack of our humanity. It's unfortunate, but what can we do? Nobody thought that the slave trade, slavery, was a moral problem until these Quakers brought it to their attention. The elite at first wanted nothing to do with these reforms. Lord Castlereagh, who was the foreign secretary, said he thought that these were left-wing agitators or sentimental idealists who could be dismissed. But the English people kept insisting that they be taken out of business with slavery. The English people, and especially the women of the North, they boycotted slave sugar. They marched, they petitioned. The men voted for anti-slavery members of parliament. Decade after decade, through changes of leadership, good years, bad years, war and peace, the English people just insisted that the slave trade must end. Overall, it took 60 years for the British to end their slave trade and then to abolish all slavery in all of their empire and then to cajole, pay other countries to stop the slave trade too. 60 years that the English people insisted that slave trade must end. It was a huge cost, and there were no compensating benefits. Once the British stopped slaving, the French and the Spanish very gladly took up the trade. English lost a lot of business. But they kept at it. We now have an estimate of the total cost to the United Kingdom for the 60 years of ending the slave trade. In 1 year, the British government spent 40% of its budget to end the slave trade. Can you imagine? 40% of its budget to end the slave trade. And the best estimate that we have is that the British economy gave up almost 2% of growth, 2% of GDP growth, each year for 60 years. Now, my friends in politics, which politicians today can you imagine standing up and saying, I have a policy which is going to cost this country almost 2% of GDP growth every year for 60 years? That would be courageous. But they did it. The British did it over all that time. Britain still managed to be the greatest empire the world had ever seen, but the country is probably a lot poorer than it would have been if they hadn't made this move. They wanted to do it, and they did it. So we're on the other side of that history, and we're probably glad that the Britons made that impossible change.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Leif Wainar is author of Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. He is currently the chair of philosophy and law at King's College in London. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we're airing a talk given back in January by Leif Wainar. He is the chair of philosophy and law at King's College in London, and he's also the author of the book Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Wainar says that our dependence on repressive regimes for their oil is fundamentally a moral problem. He says it's not unlike other immoral practices in history, including the slave trade, genocide, or apartheid in past times. It should be noted that in recent years, America has been able to become more energy independent. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, in 2014, net imports of oil accounted for 27% of the petroleum consumed in the United States, which was the lowest annual average since 1985. The top five source countries of U.S. petroleum imports in 2014 were Canada, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, followed by Venezuela, and Iraq. Here again is Leif Wainar.
For natural resources, we are on the wrong side of history. And now it looks like the change that we have to make is going to be challenging. You can probably see why, but let's just look at the forces that are probably going to resist change. Again, the proposal here is that our country should get out of business with authoritarians and armed groups and extremists who have no more title to sell the oil of the countries than that they maintain coercive control of the resources, basically that they have the most guns. We should no longer send those men our money. We shouldn't buy resources from anyone unless they could possibly be getting the approval of the people. Well, our old allies, the Saudis, are not going to like that. The old allies, the Saudis, are not going to like it when we say, who rules in your country is none of our business, but right now, your regime qualifies for none of our business. The Saudis are going to resist it. Big Oil might also conceivably have trouble with this proposal. And Big Oil is strong. what, five of the top 20, Forbes top 20 companies are big oil. The world uses a tremendous amount of oil. It's incredibly important to the global economy. Even as we shift off of fossil fuels, it's going to take a while. The world uses 1,000 barrels of oil. That's 42,000 gallons of oil every second. 90% of the world's transportation fleet runs on oil. That's almost every car, truck, ship, and plane. Even as we transition away from fossil fuels, the fleet is going to take a long time to replace. So the change will be a big one. But let me give you three reasons for hope that we can make this seemingly challenging change. The first reason for hope is that the rule that's causing so much trouble now with natural resources, and especially oil, is the same rule that once made the slave trade legal. The rule we're using for resources today is a holdover of the old international order, which was almost entirely based on a rule which can be simply summed up as might makes right. So look at what the slave trade was from a legal perspective. 250 years ago, every country's rule for human beings was whoever can seize them by force can sell them to us. Might makes right. Under that rule, 12 million Africans were forced through the gruesome Middle Passage to the Americas, where they were legally bought as property in this country and many others. Might made right. The abolition of the legal slave trade was nothing more than the abolition of that bad old rule of might makes right. That's what got us out of business with slavery, at least as an international phenomenon. That bad old rule is the same rule that's left over now for natural resources. Right now, our rule for the resources of other countries is whoever can seize it by force can sell it to us. So when Saddam took over Iraq in a violent coup many years ago, the world started buying Iraq's oil from him. And then when ISIS took over the same wells recently, the world started buying Iraq's oil from them. Our law here in this country is whoever controls it by force will buy it from them. And that's why we're in business with these dangerous petrocrats and armed groups abroad. But that should give us cause for hope. The world has overcome might makes right before, not only for slavery, but for other terrible but formerly legal phenomena like colonialism, territorial conquest, even legal apartheid. The world has overcome might makes right many times before. The rule we take entirely for granted for resources is a remnant of that old system. It'll be much easier to get on the right side of history this time. And let me just mention something I'll say more about tonight. The world is already set up for a change to happen. As it happens, almost the entire world speaks the language that the resources belong to the people. The treaties are already signed. In a sense, we know what the answer is. Governments must be accountable to their people for resource decisions. Everybody knows that's the right place to go. The challenge is actually getting there. So the first ground for hope is just that we've overcome might makes right in international affairs many times before. In fact, this has been some of the greatest advances in our history as humanity. A second ground for hope is something that's happened quite recently. which is just low oil prices. When I started writing this book 10 years ago, everyone was talking about peak oil. Oil's running out. U.S. imports were continuing their rise. And now look, all these years later, North America's awash with energy. We don't need authoritarian oil anymore. And low oil prices means that a window of opportunity is opening this year. This year, the groups that might naturally resist a proposal like this one are, honestly, weak. The Saudis, other authoritarians, are having a difficult time maintaining their financial balances, keeping their populations content. And, of course, big oil is also having a tough time right now with their balance sheets. This would be a time where fundamental change could be proposed. And let me give you the third ground for hope in this area, which is that, especially in this resource space, change is happening already, and you see even David and Goliath battles being won against powerful actors for the sake of getting more power to the people of resource-rich countries. So, as it happens, I've known these activist groups who have been trying for years to get more transparency in the oil industry. And if you know anything about oil, you know it's one of the most opaque industries in the world. It's just so hard to find out what deals are being made between the oil companies and the governments. And that makes it hard for the people of the country to know how much money the oil is being sold off for and what's happening with that money. So for years, these really smart, really skilled up activist groups have been pressuring for laws that would require American corporations to be more transparent about the deals they make with foreign governments. Now, in 2009, the activists were all worked up about that, and they had convinced two senators that this was a very important cause for long-term U.S. national security and business. But no one thought that the proposals would become law within 10 years, 20 years. The two senators introduced a bill for transparency in the oil industry. It didn't even get out of committee. Oil was strong. This was pie in the sky stuff. But the activists kept at it, and they had their stuff ready to go. They had the bill ready to go. And this has been my experience over and over. If you have your proposals, your laws, your changes ready to go when your moment comes, they can be plugged in and it works. So 2010, for that proposal, transparency in the oil industry, the window suddenly opened. I don't know if you remember that big oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. Remember that BP platform blew up? It was a terrible spill. Everything was... For that summer, big oil was toxic in Washington. Lobbyists couldn't get their phone calls returned. If they could get one message through, it was, please let us go back and drill again in the Gulf of Mexico. During that summer of 2010, oil couldn't resist these smart, skilled-up activists. The senators reintroduced that measure on the last day, when the gigantic Dodd-Frank Act was being passed through Congress, and transparency in the oil industry became law of the United States because of that activist community and their pressure. The change that people thought wouldn't happen for decades was suddenly there. And the really inspiring thing about that story, once America moved first, lots of other countries followed. Once America took that first step, as it has so many times before, and said, we are going to control our own companies in this way, or we're going to demand transparency from our own companies in this way, Europe, almost instantly followed. And now, for both the U.S. and Europe, and now Canada, and now Norway, there's an almost identical transparency requirement for all the oil companies across the board. Once someone moves first on these issues, everyone else in the West follows. So, for my issue, I'm incredibly optimistic that this change is possible. We have to have our stuff ready to go. It has to be all skilled up. You have to know your stuff. But if you're ready to go and your window opens, the window will open and it will get plugged in and change can happen. So let me wrap up the remarks by maybe asking you about the change you want to happen or maybe these proposals. My main message is change seems impossible until it comes. If we really want to do this, get out of business with authoritarians and armed groups abroad, we can do it. Change seems impossible until the moment it comes.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're broadcasting a talk by Leif Wainar. He's the author of Blood, Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. He is currently the chair of philosophy and law at King's College in London. Wainar argues that, on the face of it, the proposition of no longer buying oil from repressive, authoritarian regimes seems like a pie-in-the-sky notion. But he says that society has been able to overcome other immoral activities in the past, such as slavery or apartheid. And he says that our addiction to imported oil from repressive regimes now is not unlike those barbarous and immoral practices. Toward the end of his talk at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, Leif Wainar answered questions from students in the audience.
All right. My name is Deb White, and I am a Californian and a Utah, both. I spend equal time in both states. My friends own a smallish oil company in Houston, Texas. We've had some conversations recently that the oil wells that were capped 40 to 50 years ago, California, Houston, Texas, some of the other southern states, Louisiana, now have oil that have seeped back into those capped oil wells that could provide 10 more years of oil in which we would pull out completely from OPEC and away from the tyrannical companies that we import our oil from. Have you heard about this?
I haven't heard about that.
All right.
That's encouraging.
Secondarily, my second observation is I was just in southern Spain in December, the Andalusian area. They have acres and acres and acres of solar fields that I have never seen in this country. And we are the most sophisticated country, and yet Spain's going to be pulling off oil, I think, before we do. Yeah. It gives me great hope that there are other countries who are pulling away from oil faster than we are, it appears.
Good. Thank you so much. That sounds like we agree completely. So our own domestic oil supplies will help us get away from authoritarian oil. I was talking to Nick Butler. You might have read him in the FT. He's the energy columnist for the FT. He used to be a vice president in BP. And I asked him, how long would it take for us to get off of authoritarian oil? And he said, well, which countries? And I said, well, all the ones in the Persian Gulf, Russia.
Venezuela
is a little more complicated, but a lot of big producers, for sure. And he said, really? I said, yeah, how long would it take? Well, he thought about it for quite a while. He said North America could do it within months and it would be almost costless. Supplies would just switch around. Europe's a little harder. Europe's highly dependent on Russian oil and especially gas. Nick thought it would take a few years, 3 to 5 years maybe, and something in the range of tens of billions of dollars to build new gas infrastructure. So the economics are not impossible. It's the politics that are difficult. But look, you've given the other side of the pressure for reforms here. We just have to have an authoritarians to alternatives strategy, right? Think of the big stories that came out of Paris this last fall, what captured all our headlines. One was It was terrible terrorist attacks, drive-by shootings with heavy weapons. And the other was the big climate change conference. Both of these issues are extremely important. If we don't do something about climate, the world is going to be quite difficult in a few decades. If we don't do something about the spread of violent extremism, it's going to be very difficult for our countries too. I was talking to some security people in Washington. They're not that worried about ISIS as an existential threat. What they are worried about is Paris-style attacks by someone, ISIS 2.0, because we don't really know what to do about Paris-style attacks. Drive-by shootings with heavy weapons in the middle of an urban center, action always beats reaction. The kind of securitization that our cities would have to face to defend against that kind of attack, that's serious. So, climate, top-level issue. Authoritarianism and the spread of violent extremism, the instability in the Middle East, that's also key. We have to do both of these things at once. Let me just say, one great way to think about decarbonizing the energy supply is to think about stopping buying blood oil. What this proposal says is that 50% of the traded oil in the world right now is literally stolen by our own deepest principles. If we believe that a country belongs to its people, then this oil that's going around the world is literally stolen. Nobody should be able to buy that oil. On the most basic market principles, it's really stolen. If we had to think about the world getting by with 50% less of the traded oil right now, that would be a great stimulus to thinking about the fuels of the future, solar, the other things that we could develop. Thanks very much.
Hi, my name is Anthony. I'm an undergraduate here in the Political Science Department in Middle East Studies. My question is, so, you know, the idea to get off of oil, I totally agree with it. You know, I'm a huge proponent of fighting climate change and doing what we can now. But I think the idea to just get away from oil and just not, the other side of the argument not, is not really there. It's kind of a Western-centric idea. And the idea is that, you know, the only countries that have developed to the point of the United States or China or Russia has been through oil and natural gas or coal in the case of China. And so if you're a developing country and, you know, you have this Paris climate talk that says we're going to phase out oil and other fossil fuels, to them, and I have talked to some people who are from those countries, it's kind of like saying, well, you're just not going to develop because the other technologies are not at that level yet. So I'm just curious, how would you address that if someone said, so these big countries are kind of telling the developing ones to, oh, just kind of, you know, do your own thing, but you're not going to be able to develop because that's the only way countries have developed.
So the first thing to say is that countries that actually have natural resources, and especially oil, have not developed as much as they should. There is the resource curse. There is the oil curse. So here's a statistic. Countries that have oil in the developing world are no richer, no freer, and no more peaceful than they were in 1980. And that is in marked contrast to the rest of the developing world. So Beth and I were just talking about Sudan, South Sudan. You can see oil there is anti-development. The resource money gets poured in at the top, and that money is then available to the regimes for coercion and clientelism. They don't need to worry about the health, education, skills of their people. They basically get all the money they need to stay in power by controlling some holes in the ground. Natural resources, oil, is the largest source of unaccountable power in the world. So for countries that have natural resources, it's our rule of might makes right, being in business with whoever can keep control over the holes in the ground that keeps the political economies of these countries so dysfunctional. Some countries with oil have transitioned away from the worst, but mostly it's when they start running out of oil per capita. Mexico's doing much better. Indonesia's doing much better. Nigeria's doing much better, thank goodness. But it's mostly when they start running out of oil per capita. There's just not enough oil money to do the coercion and the buying of loyalty, so the people have to be given more power. on development in countries that need energy, we just have to find the most feasible flight path for development to happen in those countries. And it has to involve alternatives. My own view is actually the big problem there is coal. Coal is the dirtiest of them all. It's the one that these countries are importing. Bill Gates says we need an energy miracle. My own view is we really need a miracle around coal. It's going to be so difficult to get these countries to stop importing coal if we could get carbon capture and storage in a way that was economically feasible. That would be my number one priority, and I hope our brilliant scientists turn their attention to that.
Hey, my name is Jacob Argue. My question is, oil is obviously like the main thing. You hear about wars over oil, that kind of thing. But all these countries, authoritarian regimes, military rule, that kind of thing. That also happens in countries which aren't dominated by oil necessarily, but by gold, rubber, diamonds.
Yes.
Would you take that to the next level and say all natural resources?
I would. For many reasons. So here's one reason, is that resources cause problems for just this reason, because we have this rule of might makes right for resources. So in my smartphone, in your smartphone, there might be a small piece of the Congo. Congo, as you know, has hosted what some people call the world's worst war for a long time. Vicious militias there are extracting the metals that go into our tech. How are we in business relations with those guys? It might be that the metal in my phone was extracted at gunpoint by some rebel group in the eastern Congo. They obviously stole the resources. No way they could have owned it. But somehow, when those resources get here to the United States of America, I own my phone, every single molecule, 100% under the laws of this country and this state. No one can challenge me to my ownership of these molecules. Police and courts here will defend my right 100%. Might there makes right here, literally legal rights here. We are in business with the men of blood abroad. This is the resource curse, and it happens especially around oil, diamonds, and metals, because these are highly concentrated sources of economic value you can just rip out of the ground, either with slave labor or with imported foreign labor, and which can be extracted even in the middle of authoritarianism or conflict. Basically, when we say might makes right, there's just huge reservoirs of cash buried underground. And whoever has enough guns to control the holes in the ground will get all that cash, which they can use to buy more bullets or bayonets or maintain power of a whole country if they can. So might makes right for resources is causing the resource curse. And let me just say, luckily, the world has already set itself up to change to a better rule, to shift all of resource trade onto a better rule. So, trivia fact to impress your friends with, there's only one right that's asserted twice in both of the major human rights treaties. And that one right that's repeated is, all peoples shall, for their own ends, freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources. People should control their resources. It's the only thing, both of the big covenants, civil and political, economic, social, cultural, that's the only right. Almost every country in the world has already ratified one or the other of those treaties. US, China, India, Brazil, South Africa. 98% of the people in the world already live in a country that has ratified one of these big human rights covenants, which says the resources are the people's birthright. Resource decisions have to be accountable to the people. So the current rule for natural resources is causing no end of trouble. The new rule is waiting for us there. We already talk the talk. We just have to take the steps to make that principle reality in our own law.
So if they're in both these human rights conventions, would you think that would be a logical step to go to Congress and say these countries have human rights violations, we can't possibly be doing it with them?
Yeah. That's right. It's a human rights principle that the resources belong to people. It's an American principle. Abraham Lincoln, in his first inaugural, starts out saying, the country belongs to its people. It's not a partisan principle in America, it's an American principle. So let me quote both sides of the aisle. Senator Bob Graham of Florida, Democrat of Florida, said not long ago, it's a fundamental fact that the oil and gas off of our shores is an American resource. It belongs to the people of the United States of America. And George Bush in 2006, when he's talking about Iraq's oil, said Iraqi oil belongs to the Iraqi people. It's their asset. Everybody already talks this way. It's a totally natural way to talk. No one believes that old rule of might makes right. It's obviously crazy. So the world is set up already, rhetorically and on paper, for us to make this change. U.S. Congress, it's not convincing people that this is the right thing to do. It's convincing them that we can do it at a reasonable cost. And I think if we look especially to the medium term, long term, in terms of our own national interests, we certainly can.
My name is Christopher Collard. I'm a recent graduate. I'm curious a little bit more about how you would define the difference between a country that's responsible to its people and one that's not.
Yeah.
And you have these kind of tricky examples like Venezuela and like Iran, which in some by some measures has a more democratic electoral system than the United States does. So like where is the line drawn between oil that we find acceptable and oil that's yeah. not?
Thank you. It's a great question. I've worked really hard on this. As a philosopher, you want good theory, but you also need theory that can draw bright lines in international affairs that everyone can agree on. So let's just take this seriously for a second. What if we really wanted to make it our own law that resources belong to the people? How could we tell? Simple tests, four simple tests. Can the citizens of the country find out what's happening with their oil? Can they get basic information? Who's getting the money? What's happening to the money? Can citizens talk about that with each other without fearing disappearance, injury, or death? Can citizens peacefully protest what the government's doing with their oil without fearing disappearance, injury, or death? And if a majority of citizens strongly disagree with what the government is doing, will the government policy change in a reasonable time? That's all I mean for the government to be accountable to the people. We're not talking Western liberal democracy here. Bare bones. Civil liberties and political rights. So there's a lot of scales that measure this. If you want to take the most famous one, it's Freedom House. It's been around for a long time. All we're talking about is countries that are above the level of not free on Freedom House. So Freedom House measures civil liberties, political rights. If you're not free, if you're Saudi Arabia or Equatorial Guinea, there's no chance that your citizens meet those tests. There's no chance that your citizens have enough civil liberties and political rights to be holding the government accountable for their resource decisions. So those are the countries we shouldn't buy resources from, just because it would be stolen from the people. Now, these criteria of control are not demanding, right? I will tell you that on Freedom House, Venezuela is above the line. So I think this is actually fairly plausible. Venezuela has a lot of trouble, even more as we go on. But the people can tell what's happening with their resources. They can control their resources. That doesn't mean that the people are going to make great decisions about their resources. My view is that the Chavez period was a popularly supported movement, which led to a lot of trouble, drove their economy into the ground, all sorts of disasters now. But that's something the people approved. Now, sometimes when I say the people own the oil, the people own the resources, the response is, oh, that must be socialism. But no, this is an American principle, right? This is something that George W. Bush says. He's not a socialist. As long as the government's accountable to the people, anything can happen to the resources as long as the people could possibly be agreeing to it. So here in America, resources start out in the hands of the people, but here we privatize the resources, and that's fine. Resources are privatized under laws that are passed by accountable legislators. That oil in the Gulf is auctioned off to private companies, and the money goes into the treasury. Perfectly fine. Privatize it, nationalize it, leave it in the ground. Governments can do anything with the natural resources of the country as long as what they're doing could possibly be done with the people's assent. That's the test. Thank you.
See, my name is Ron Anderson. I'm an alumni. It seems like a lot of the international conflicts in the world are based on historical arguments that can be taken back this number of years or that number of years, or and a lot of the arguments are based on what happened years ago, and the other side will say, well, this happened a few years before that or 100 years before that. And I guess it just complicates it to a great degree, it seems like to me. And even for America, who basically stole this land at the point of a gun from the indigenous people, and you know, how do we reconcile all those, I mean, the historical context of how these nations all developed in various ways, and not always democratically, for sure.
Yeah. It's true the land was often stolen at the point of a gun. That was just another instance of might makes right. So as far as the international community was concerned, that was completely legitimate. It used to be the law of nations that if you could capture land by force, you got to rule that land. That's just another instance of our overcoming might makes right. According to the UN Charter, you may no longer capture land by force. So, at least in this extent, we've overcome that rule now. Thank goodness. When we talk about oil, we usually get into these debates about whether we've made the right foreign policy choices, whether we should have invaded Iraq to unseat Saddam, whether we should have invaded Libya to unseat Gaddafi, whether we should have invaded Syria, unseat Assad. We talk about the choices that we've made from a big picture. The real problem is the choices that we've had, what the military people call the strategic environment. Because we use this bad old rule for oil, the strategic environment is incredibly degraded. All of our choices coming out of these oil-rich countries are lose-lose. Time and again, we're faced with impossible political choices coming out of these countries where whatever we do is going to be a disaster. Oil is the largest source of unaccountable power in the world. The main mechanisms we have for keeping the power in check of these autocrats and armed groups are sanctions and military action. And those are very clumsy tools for doing the job. They're expensive, cause a lot of deaths, and they often have severe unintended consequences. So, our rule for oil gives us lose-lose foreign policy choices. And I have to say, it's not only that this rule sets foreigners against each other, oppression and war, and it's not only that it sets them against us with these hostile autocrats and the extremists who are trying to do us harm. I have to say, one of the most poignant parts of this degraded strategic environment is it sets us against each other. We have to detoxify our politics somehow Think of the people of goodwill that you know on both sides of these debates over Iran, Libya, Syria. Think how much fire there have been amongst well-intentioned people about which impossible foreign policy choice we would take, and then who's to blame for the disaster that happened because we took one or the other. It really kills me to see the United States of America so divided because of these impossible foreign policy challenges that keep coming at us. We have to manage these challenges as well as we can, but both for our own security and for our own polity, we should figure out if we can dissolve the impossible, no-win foreign policy dilemmas that are coming to us down the road too by changing our rules for how we buy resources.
Perhaps one more question for our speaker.
There's another in front.
I don't want to take it away from the students here. I prefer a student.
No, I agree. Yeah. You are.
Oil reminds me of all the studies that I've done, all of the money.
And I go back, I guess in recent history, to 1953 in Iran, when the monarchy was deposed at that point and the people had a democratic election and a gentleman named Mossadegh became prime minister. And he decided that the resource of oil belonged to the people and he wanted to nationalize the oil. So circuitously, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company went to our government and we, with the CIA, overthrew Mossadegh and brought in the Shah. Of course, that started the next many years of distrust until we were overthrown in 1979. So even though the resources, and he was right, the resources do belong to the people, but the question is we've done this through history. This is not an isolated case. And fast forward Libya in 2011. It was about the money, it was about the oil, the purest oil you could find, and four recipients were the Europeans, four European countries. And I was over in Libya just about that time. And Muammar Gaddafi made it very difficult for the oil ministers, and they wanted him out. So it wasn't about the Arab Spring, as I believe the cover is, it was about the oil again, and the CIA went in there as well, trying to disrupt that government. So, but we can go through all these different areas, and I can talk about that. What's your opinion about the political, geopolitical aspects of this? Because it's not going to go away.
Yeah.
It's always going to be about the money, and it's always going to be about that the resources don't belong to the people, which they do. And you're having the same things unfolding in many of the 54 African countries today as it has over the last 50 years.
Thank you so much, such an articulate comment. I'm sure we could learn a lot from you and your experience with this. I couldn't add anything to your experience with this. Let me just say my own view. In the short term, from the perspective of any government, it always makes sense to keep sending our money and our support to the authoritarians and sometimes to the armed groups. Long term, it's a disaster. The people of these countries are going to get power one way or another. They're young, they've got communication, they've got better logistics, they're getting weapons. They're going to get power one way or another. The hard way for them to get power is if we keep supporting the men who are oppressing and attacking them, because the people will know whose side we're on. The better way is for us to take a stand on our own principle and build what we need most in international affairs, which is trust with the people of the world, and say, look, we're on your side. We're going to be on your side as you gain power. That will embolden the reformers that there are in these countries, outside the palaces, oftentimes inside the palace, to make a more gradual constitutional positive change. Short-term, the incentives are always wrong. Long-term, we've got to get on the side of the people by standing up for our own principles and getting out of business with the Men of Blood.
Again, Leif Wainar is author of Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. He spoke at the University of Utah a few weeks back. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.